This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed their vast differences on trade that have led to exchanges of significant retaliatory tariffs. They did agree to a small truce in their war. Mr. Trump described their relationship as incredible and predicted something good is forthcoming for both Beijing and Washington. Mr. Xi spoke through an interpreter.
China and the United States, two important countries with major influence in the world, shoulder important responsibilities for international peace and prosperity. Only with cooperation between us can we serve the interest of world peace and prosperity.
Many major business leaders in both the United States and China are hoping for some sort of deal in what is seen as an escalating trade dispute between the world's two largest economies. On his flight back to Washington from the G20, Mr. Trump said he expects to meet with North Korea's leader in January or even in February. Details on funeral arrangement for former U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who died late Friday at the age of 94, are being set by the Bush family. Mr. Bush, who served as president from 1989 to 1993, will receive a state funeral Wednesday at the National Cathedral here in Washington. That will be followed by burial Thursday. President Trump spoke about Mr. Bush.
I express deepest sympathies. Angela and I were just talking about it. He was a wonderful man. He was just a high-quality man who truly loved his family. One thing that came through loud and clear, he was very proud of his family. And very much loved his family.
President Bush was married for 73 years to his wife Barbara, who died at the age of 92 in April of this year. They had two daughters and four sons and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. This is VOA News. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev expressed his deep condolences to the family of former U.S. President George H.W. Bush and all Americans following his death. Gorbachev worked closely with Bush to bring an end to the Cold War in the late 1980s and 90s and lauded the former president for his abilities as a politician and his personal character. U.S. President Trump says he is willing to agree to a two-week extension of government funding to avoid conflicts with the ceremonies honoring the late president, George H.W. Bush. Speaking on board Air Force One on his way home from the G20 summit in Argentina, Mr. Trump said congressional leaders have asked for the extension because of Bush's funeral Wednesday. Funding for some government operations is currently set to run out on Friday, although much of the U.S. government has already been funded through next September. Protesters angry about rising taxes clashed with French police for a third straight weekend, and dozens were arrested after pockets of demonstrators built barricades in the middle of streets in central Paris, lit fires and threw rocks at officers. AP's Zary Shackley.
Protesters, including some wearing black hoodies, piled up large plywood planks and other material in the middle of a street near the Arc de Triomphe and set the debris on fire. Police fired tear gas and used water cannons to try to push back the protesters who gathered around there. Some demonstrators responded by throwing large rocks. The monument was seen late in the day, tagged with the words, "The Yellow Vests Triumph," in reference to the fluorescent vests protesters wear. I'm Zeria Shakili.
Israeli police Sunday said that they had found enough evidence for bribery and fraud charges to be brought against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife in a third corruption case against the Israeli leader. Asked about the political future of Netanyahu, Israelis in Jerusalem voiced faith in the justice system. Some said they hoped this would force Netanyahu to step down. Hey, guy, Netanami Tomi is one of them.
I think this news brings us some hope for a better future. Because I think we had enough from Netanyahu, the prime minister. I think it was really bad. It took all our hopes and all our hopes and plans for the future. And I think this will put an end for his period as the prime minister. I really hope so.
Netanyahu denies any wrongdoing, but if indicted, the four-term prime minister would be facing one of the greatest challenges to his political survival. Despite his dominance of Israeli politics, the newest police recommendation comes just after his right-wing coalition's majority was reduced to one seat in parliament. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Netline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Peter Klote has the day off.
He says the only caveat is that he thinks it's necessary for the government to register all the refugees if they are going to stay.
Senegalese refugees in Guinea-Bissau are finally getting identification cards.
We cannot be hosting an event when we know that the two English-speaking regions are not at peace. They are killing people. So it's good for the president to come back and sit and talk with the Anglophone regions so that there should be peace.
Mixed reactions in Cameroon after the Confederation of African Football withdrew the 2019 Continental Soccer event hosting rights from the Central African state.
The potential loss over the next 10 years, 40% drop in exports, 30% drop in employment. That's the type of reality that we're facing if we stop investment.
And we look at the risks in South Africa's attempts to reform its land holdings. Those stories and more coming up right here on Netline Africa. After years of living in a state of limbo, Senegalese refugees in Guinea-Bissau are finally getting identification cards. Some have been in the small West African country for more than two decades after fleeing unrest in Senegalese Casamance region. For VOA, Richie Shyrock has more from the town of Pelondo.
Okay, Ibrahim Ingo, il va voir votre nom sur la liste.
Ibrahim Ingo fled southern Senegal in 1992 due to unrest in the country's Casamance region. Since then, he has lived in Pelondo, near Guinea-Bissau's border with Senegal. Today marks the first time he will register to receive his national identification card as a Guinea-Bissau citizen.
Oh, c'est beaucoup plus important d'avoir la nationalité de la Guinée-Bissau.
He says the documents are important because they will allow him to move about the country freely without having to pay small bribes to the police, a tax often applied to foreigners. This year, the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, began registering the nearly 10,000 Senegalese refugees living in the country after Guinea-Bissau announced it would grant citizenship to all Senegalese refugees within its borders. Like Ibrahima, many of them arrived over two decades ago. Since 1982, waves of Senegalese have fled Casamance, the site of a low-intensity conflict between the government and the separatist movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance. UNHCR official Binyatona says before becoming naturalized, the refugees had trouble moving around the country freely. He adds the national ID cards will also enable them to acquire a passport for future international travel if needed. Guinea-Bissau ranks as the 11th least developed country on the UN Development Index. Despite a lack of economic opportunities, Guinea-Bissau residents in the region have mostly welcomed their Senegalese neighbors, says Ingo. When he arrived, Pelondo residents gave him land he could use to grow cashews and earn an income, he says. A resident of Pelondo, Ocha Kamara, says he does not mind if the refugees stay as long as they follow the rules of the country. He says the only caveat is that he thinks it's necessary for the government to register all the refugees if they are going to stay. On this day, 334 Senegalese refugees in Pelondo are getting their ID cards. Ami Jata reflects on what the new documents mean to her and her family. She says that without paperwork, you're treated like a foreigner, but with the papers, she will have fewer problems. That also means almost 27 years after Jata fled her village, she will now have the freedom to call Guinea-Bissau home. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Pelondo, Guinea-Bissau.
There has been mixed reactions in Cameroon after the Confederation of African Football, CAF, withdrew the 2019 Continental Soccer event hosting rights from the Central African state. The government has described the CAF decision as total injustice, while some of the people say the suspension should act as an eye-opener for the government to solve the crisis that has destabilized the English-speaking region for more than 2 years. For VOA, Moki, Edwin Kinzuka reports from Yaounde.
Night shift workers transport roofing material and seats to the Olembe Stadium on the outskirts of Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. It is here the government of Cameroon had announced the opening and closing matches of the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations would take place. Work supervisor Angel Tamin says they are working nights and days so that the stadium should be ready by March 2019, 3 months before the official kickoff of the competition.
For the main stadium, all the structural elements are here, almost 100%. When it comes to, and obviously the installation, as you can see, I mean, you know, it's extremely advanced, and the main stadium bowl will be finished in terms of structures. And as you can see now, it's not only foundations and columns, but you can see slabs that are ready.
Issa Chiruma, Cameroon government spokesperson and Minister of Communication, says the government has instructed all companies working on infrastructure projects for the football feast to continue as if CAF had not stripped hosting rights from Cameroon.
Cameroon has put in a creditable performance. It shall prove it to the entire world by completing with the same determination and on time the construction of this modern infrastructure belonging to the Cameroonian people, our country, which has written the pages of African football in bold letters, will not relent her effort in working with other African countries to develop football in our beloved Africa.
Issa Chiruma says Cameroon, a five-time African football champion, agreed to host the prestigious African event, even though CAF decided to increase the size of the tournament from 16 to 24 teams without asking its opinion. But during Friday's extraordinary meeting of CAF's executive committee in Accra, Ghana, the football body said the infrastructure was not ready. They also raised security concerns, especially in the restive English-speaking regions where armed conflicts have continued for more than 2 years, leading to deaths of more than 1,200 civilians, fighters, and military personnel, and leaving hundreds of thousands displaced. Gladys Matute, a 24-year English-speaking Cameroonian, says she is very okay with the decision to remove hosting rights from Cameroon until peace is negotiated in the restive regions.
We cannot be hosting an event when we know that the two English-speaking regions are not at peace. They are killing people. So it's good for the president to come back and sit and talk with the Anglophone regions so that there should be peace. Paul Biya should sit up and then there should be some peace talk.
Secondary school student Rose Gani says she expected CAF to withdraw the hosting rights a long time ago.
We are not surprised because embassies have been refusing their citizens from traveling to Cameroon, especially to the northwest and southwest. And also, we have the Boko Haram fight in the far north. Moreover, all the towns to host are suffering from insecurity. There's also fear that when the tournament will be going on, the Amazonian fighters might attack people in Yaounde.
The 2019 finals will take place from June 15 to July 13, a change from the traditional January period. Cameroon had proposed 5 cities, Limbe, Bafoussam, Douala, Garoua, and the capital Yaounde as competition venues. CAF says it has initiated an urgent and open call for a new host. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
In Nigeria, the Universal Basic Education Commission has said that population of Nigeria's out-of-school children increased from 10 million to 13 million. This was disclosed by Secretary of the Board, Dr. Hamid Baiboyi, at a United Nations Children briefing on out-of-school children. He said factors that led to the increase are the Boko Haram war, increased number of births, and children displaced by the conflict. The report also said that many of the affected children are from the northern part of Nigeria. The Nigerian government has not reacted to the report. Dr. Raphael James is an educationist and Lagos-based media researcher. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonyi about the implications of the increase in out-of-school children in Nigeria.
Well, actually it is, because if we're having 30 million kids who are supposed to be in school to be out of school, that's a serious crisis in the hand of the government and people of Nigeria. At this rate, we're going to have a situation where in the next couple of years, we're going to have more people drawing the country backwards because they don't have proper education. And I think something has to be done about it, and it has to be done immediately.
What should the government, aid agencies, and relevant bodies do to send the children back to school?
In the olden days, back in the 40s and 50s, even some of the people who are presently in government, they all had free education then that they attended. I think government should actually take it upon themselves. Recently, I understand the government came up with this policy of breaking down, cutting down cost of JAMB and all that. But I think beyond that, they should introduce free education, at least at the primary school level. This will encourage more people to go to school.
Some educationists and development experts have suggested that children affected by the Boko Haram war be given special classes in internally displaced camps. Do you agree?
Yes, I totally agree to that. It's just like the same thing that happened during the Nigerian Civil War. During the Civil War, some of the Biafran kids were given special classes because, of course, they can't be in class when there's a war. The same thing that is happening with the Boko Haram, the areas affected by Boko Haram presently. So special classes should be introduced to encourage them to learn during the period of the crisis.
Some scholars have blamed government officials in northern Nigeria for not doing enough to encourage children to go to school. What's your take on this?
It has been an ongoing thing. It's not new. Let me give you a practical example. The current presidential candidate under the PDP, Atiku Abubakar, for example, at a point in time in his life, his father was sentenced to prison because he did not allow him to go to school. But now, I wish the father was alive to see that that same boy he didn't allow to go to school is now running to become the president of Nigeria. It's just a change of orientation. Let them understand that education is needed. Education is not taking them backwards. It's actually going to improve them. So the people of the northern area should do all they can to encourage their wards and their kids to acquire Western education.
How does Boko Haram threat affect education for children in neighboring countries such as Cameroon, Chad, and Niger? Are they also seeing a similar problem?
On that one, let me mention something. I don't know how correct am I, but let me tell you this. Do you believe that because of the crisis happening in the northern area, some of these neighboring countries, their kids do migrate into Nigeria? There are high chances of that. And when things like this happen, we group all of them now as Nigerians. But this actually is not true. They are all not Nigerians. They are immigrants who have come into the country because our borders are open because of the crisis that are going on. So I think presently the United Nations and the other agencies that are involved should come together and put up more schools, put up more infrastructures in these areas to encourage these kids to acquire education. And when necessary, provide food, because, I mean, no hungry child is going to go to school. We're having situations where we see most of them are living in hunger. So let them provide enough food, provide a convenient environment for them, and provide good education for them.
That was Dr. Raphael James, an educationist and Lagos-based media researcher. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonyi. South Africa wants to reform its land holdings, and the economic upside of doing it successfully could be significant. Getting more land into the hands of black farmers could increase incomes for thousands of families. But there are risks, and reform done badly could set the economy back for years. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports on potential financial impacts of the reforms.
Some economists warn that South Africa's economy could implode if the government abruptly takes white farmers' land to redistribute. They say it could trigger the collapse of the rand and a dramatic decrease in food production. Azar Jamin is head of the economic consulting firm Econometrics. He says the mere announcement that the ruling African National Congress wanted to take white-owned land killed off a nascent economic recovery by scaring off both domestic and foreign investment.
The acrimony surrounding the whole issue, which has involved a lot of emotions, has done a lot of damage to business and consumer confidence. Some would say it's even led to some emigration of skilled people from the country.
Land prices have decreased 30% since the start of the year, when the ANC said it would turn to expropriating land without compensation if needed. Professor Ferdi Meyer is the director of the country's Bureau for Food and Agricultural Policy. He says equity in land possession must happen, given that white farmers still control more than 70% of the best commercial farmland. But, he says, the ANC's announcement couldn't have come at a worse time, with unemployment approaching 30%, a recession battering the country, and tax revenue at an all-time low.
In this period where we want to do the land reform, we need to acknowledge that the profit margins and agriculture margins are under pressure. Money has run out, government finances are tight, and private...
Mayor points out that farming is still suffering the aftermath of a drought, the listeria disease that infected certain meat products, and low grain prices. He says those problems must be considered as the government looks for ways to help more black South Africans become commercial farmers. Mayor says the long list of hardships white farmers face, including the possibility that they'll lose their land, means they're not investing as much in their businesses as they should. He notes one table grape farm he has studied where the owner is not planting new vines.
The potential loss over the next 10 years, 40% drop in exports, 30% drop in employment. That's the type of reality that we're facing if we stop investment in the farm. So that's why we need to get it right. We need to get the policies right and incentives right to avoid this. We need to have a sustainable food system based on a fair and just land reform model.
Jamin says that outcome is within relatively easy reach. A good starting point for the government, he says, would be to grant title deeds to the estimated 20 million smallhold and subsistence farmers. The state and various tribal councils currently own the land these farmers work. That means they can't use the land title as collateral for loans, for seed and equipment.
If one were to unleash the ability to hold title within so many millions of people, you could suddenly see a dramatic unraveling of wealth in South Africa that could see the economy booming strongly.
As yet, there's no land reform proposal before Parliament. President Cyril Ramaphosa has assured local and international business leaders the government's plan will respect property rights. Even so, the possibility of expropriating land without paying white owners remains on the table. That disconnect, says Jamin, does nothing but harm to South Africa's efforts to attract new investment. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
In Uganda, the Uganda entertainment industry is growing in popularity, but sometimes there's limited awareness among artists, filmmakers and producers on the importance of protecting their work and the value of the intellectual property. VOA's Paul Ndiho has more.
The entertainment industry plays a role in giving a livelihood to many Ugandans, even in the face of challenges. Unfortunately, most entertainers say they are struggling to commercialize and earn money from their work. A new startup, a Kampala-based organization called Intellectual Property, wants to change that narrative. They're going across the country to teach people in the entertainment industry how to protect and profit from their intellectual creations.
We've been having a couple of trying to sensitize the filmmakers and the musicians into grasping the main aspect of the copyright law, wherein they should be able to know where their rights fall and how they can commercialize and earn forever their type of music and works they have created.
Norman Mbabazi says that his organization has hit the ground running, and so far they are getting a lot of attention in the entertainment industry.
We come up with an intellectual property organization, and our focus is to push down the information so that people can be able to utilize them and make ends meet, considering the unemployment rates that we have in Uganda. We believe that the creative economy can be one of the saviors of such a situation.
Intellectual property experts say the most significant obstruction to IP growth for entertainers in Uganda seems to be the lack of knowledge on how to protect their work.
The law is the protection bit of it. So it creates the platform whereby you are able to make money and earn a living from what you have created. Unlike copyright, where sometimes registration is not necessary, but other intellectual property arrangements, trademarks, patents, utility models, all those industrial designs, among others, require that you have to give information, then they give you protection.
What kind of challenges do you run into when these musicians or artists come to you looking for help?
The challenges they face, one, are awareness. Two is conceptualization of the rights. And definitely three is how to earn, how to transform popularity into money.
Despite the challenges, Mbabazi says they've had some success. For example, his organization represented a Bobby Wine, a Ugandan pop star turned lawmaker, settled out of court after Uganda's Electoral Commission used one of his songs during the campaign in 2016 without his authorization.
Bobby Wine is a client of ours. We've also had some works to do with him, especially his he had a song about election, and he was saying that elections should not be a cause for division. And I think the Electoral Commission used the song without his authorization during campaigns in 2016, and through court, we litigated part of the matter and settled it out of court, and he got some compensation. So that kind of experience is beginning to grow up.
But the government is making significant advances in strengthening the administration and management of intellectual property rights, including a parliament enacting a significant IP legislation. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Angola's most famous operatic tenor hopes to inspire more Africans to take up the classical music form. Nelson Ebo has performed around the world and is currently starring with the Heartbeat Opera Company on stage in New York. He recently sang in Washington, where VOA's Portuguese service, Maria de la Salat, met up with him.
Nelson Ebo started singing at church in Angola's capital, Luanda, where he says he met the person who opened doors to a wider world.
I'm an Angolan tenor. I came from Angola, from singing in church. And then from there, I met Mr. Mario Gama, that was our national folkloric singer. And he also used to sing in church. So he took me to sing with him in all the concerts, in churches.
Ebo sang at events at the Performance Hall in Luanda, and at 18, impressed the listener enough to win a scholarship.
Someone from the UN came and he told me, well, let's get out of here. I'll take you to Spain. And you will be studying music in there because you have a great talent to sing opera. I'm like, okay, well, let's do this.
Ebo's main concern, he was the main breadwinner for his parents and some of his 14 siblings.
We had a very difficult life there, and actually, that took me to do this work, right? To go and sing everywhere and get the money, bring the money, and give to them and help them so they would eat the next day. I was feeling guilty from leaving them. But on the other hand, it was fantastic to go to a different country and sing opera.
His coaches in Spain included Plácido Domingo, one of his heroes.
As an Angolan, and that is something that doesn't happen.
Ebo moved to the United States in 2008 to study and perform. Since then, he has been on stages around the world. Whenever he goes on stage, he recalls leaving his relatives years ago.
They're the feeling for everything, like seeing them there in that door waiting for me, saying goodbye to me, and me going to that UN car that was right stopping on my door.
At age 34, the tenor says he has another dream to fulfill, teaching young people about opera.
I wanted to go one day to Angola. Now that I'm in this fantastic career, and bring my talent, bring everything I learned to make them learn the beautiful world of music.
That would be another high note in Nelson Ebo's lofty music career. Myra de La Salette, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
This is the Voice of America in Washington, and coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, and our Sunday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And now in Nightline Africa sports. Well, let's begin with boxing. It was one of the most anticipated heavyweight battles in recent memory. It went all the way between the two undefeated fighters, living up to its intense billing. It ended in a draw. In his first bout of significance since he shocked the world by upsetting his way to the heavyweight championship in 2015, Tyson Fury survived a pair of hilarious knockdowns, including one in round 12, and appeared to outclass WBC champion Deontay Wilder before settling for a split draw in front of 18,000 fans at Staples Center in Los Angeles. The first heavyweight title pay-per-view bout in America since 2002 saw both fighters combine for a modern classic that was overflowing with tension and drama. One judge had it considerably wild at 115 to 111 for Wilder, while the second had it at 114 to 112 for Fury. The final scorecard was 113 to 113. Both fighters remained undefeated. And now on to football. Nigeria are the champions of the 2018 Women's Africa Cup of Nations. Nigeria on Saturday beat South Africa 4-3 on penalties in the final in Accra, Ghana. The match had ended goalless after 120 minutes, with Nigeria's goalkeeper Tochukwu Olwihi making the trophy-winning save in the shootout from the boot of South Africa's Linda Matalo. The Super Falcons, who came to Ghana as defending champions, retained their dominance in this competition, winning the trophy for the ninth time in 11 editions. Nigeria and South Africa will now prepare for next year's World Cup in France, where they will be joined by Cameroon, who booked their place on Friday. In another development, Cameroon have been stripped of hosting next year's Africa Cup of Nations, according to the Confederation of African Football, CAF. CAF says it's because of delays in progress of Cameroon's preparations for the tournament due to start in June. Officials made the decision at a meeting on Friday in Accra, Ghana, that lasted more than 10 hours. CAF President Ahmed Ahmed says CAF will work to determine a new organizing country by the end of the year. CAF added postponing the tournament was not possible due to contractual commitments. The tournament is said to be the first held in June and July and will be expanded from 16 to 24 teams. Meanwhile, Senegal replaced Tunisia, the highest-ranked African national team, in the monthly rankings by FIFA. The Tarengo Lions rose from second place in the rankings following their 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying victory in Equatorial Guinea. Tunisia lost away to Egypt in the same competition and were also beaten at home by Morocco in a friendly. Mauritania, who qualified for the Nations Cup for the first time in their history, were among the African teams to go up in the rankings. They rose by three places in the world and are just outside the top 20 African nations. Morocco, who moved up seven places, were the top 50's biggest climbers after morale boosting victories over Tunisia and Cameroon. Only five African countries, Senegal, Tunisia, Morocco, Nigeria, and DR Congo, were among the top 50 in the world. Amongst other African teams improving in the rankings were Uganda, Mozambique, Sudan, Liberia, Comoros, and the Gambia. Finally, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has revealed the preliminary lists of nominees for the 2018 Africa's Men's and Women's Player of the Year Awards. 34 names have been revealed for the men's category, with 8 of the nominees playing in the English Premier League. Last year's winner, Egypt's forward Mohamed Salah, is joined on the list by his two Liverpool teammates, Sadio Mane of Senegal and Guinea's international Naby Keita. 12 men on the list play their football in Africa. CAF previously had an African Best Player of the Year category, which has now stopped. Morocco's first appearance at a World Cup since 1998 is reflected on the list, with five players nominated, more than from any other country. The other African nations play at Russia 2018, that's Egypt, Nigeria, Senegal and Tunisia, all have three players on the list, whilst Algeria, who failed to qualify for Russia, have four, including former CAF Player of the Year Riyad Mahrez. Mauritania are also on the list for Men's National Team of the Year, alongside Madagascar, Guinea-Bissau, Kenya, Uganda and Zimbabwe. In the women's category, Nigeria and Cameroon both have four players on the list of 15. The coaches from all four Women's Nations Cup semi-finalists, Nigeria, South Africa, Cameroon and Mali, plus Zambia, have also been nominated for the Women's Coach of the Year award. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get relaxed and reflect with music from the continent.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Baby girl, dance for me one time. Secreto. Mi uno feni kunata. Secreto. Tena jifunge nangata. Secreto. Zile za kibao kata. Oh, yeah. Baby girl, dance for me one time. Secreto. Mi uno feni kunata. Secreto. Tena jifunge nangata. Secreto. La 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 la. Katik, katika, katik, katika, katik, katika.
Asana yo spesi simulunda
kaza sibwe manya kazanyo era uribambuza lwache mofanto muda monti katika richi mwecho Simulingiriza muakabanga Kale wadolo mumbuza Naye wasirika Sikaka ansa Esimu veimba Simu soya soya Zesiri loya
Here's a song that comes from Tanzania. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ingekuwa wa maliwe, ingekuwa wa hatada. Nashindwa na mali sina we.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The United States lost a great and decent leader last Friday in the person of George Howard Walker Bush, the 41st President of the United States. This commentator had the privilege of working closely with President Bush while he was the permanent representative of the United States at the United Nations. At the time he served there, I was working as advisor to Ambassador Gunayarin, who was the representative on the Middle East, and I was his principal advisor on the Middle East negotiations. I was also working on attempts to restore peacekeeping at the United Nations after the debacle of the Congo Operation 1960 to 1964. These are two issues which were of interest to then Ambassador Bush, and he was in close contact with me to get regular briefing. This is how I got to know him extremely well. He was a man of exceptional knowledge and high integrity. He seems to me that he respected everyone, no matter what the race was. He served at the United Nations at the time when the African influence at the General Assembly was at its highest. And he was constantly inquiring for me what was the position of the African group on a wide array of issues before the United Nations. Regrettably for him, he came across the influence of the African group when the General Assembly was discussing the proper representation of China at the United Nations. The African group was led by young, brilliant Tanzanian ambassador Salim Salim. He had served as ambassador to China before becoming the permanent representative of Tanzania at the UN. And he mobilized the African group and the non-aligned group to seek the proper representation of China at the United Nations. And at that vote and the celebration of the African group led by Ambassador Salim Salim was something that President Bush never forgot. And it turned out to have been the one issue which denied for Ambassador Salim Salim the Secretary Generalship of the United Nations. He had full support in the Security Council, but President Bush at the time could not forget that he led the fight for China's representation at the UN. I could also remember Ambassador Bush, what he did at the United Nations when we discussed issues of economic development for Africa. And he pressed for the issue of the so-called economic department, which was made the second representative of the secretariat. when he became the president, he led the fight to ensure that the Charter of the United Nations is respected. When Saddam Hussein entered Kuwait, he mobilized the world community. I happen to have been in these discussions, and what was key for him was that at the time the charter was signed or fortified, the obliteration of the state, Kuwait, from the face of the world map was something which he could not accept. And he mobilized the international community and the UN, and he prevailed. But he did not agree with those who advised him to go to Baghdad to topple Saddam Hussein. And he said his duty was to restore the sovereignty of Kuwait. I could also remember the role he played when Somalia was in great turmoil. When Boutros-Boutros-Ghali became Secretary General, and I was asked to represent the UN to end the war in Somalia, when we came back and established some kind of United Nations peacekeeping role, and when we encountered difficulties, President Bush, even after he had lost his election in 1992, wrote to the Secretary General that he would like to help in Somalia. And he sent the first American contingent to Somalia. And this man, who was such a decent man and interacted widely with all delegates, particularly African delegates, shocked me during his campaign of 1988 when the issue of crime came in the fight against Dukakis, and there was a racist campaign, and I couldn't believe it. Later on, it became known that he was not part of it, even though it was made on his behalf. So we mourn the death of a man who appears to be the last generation of statesmen of the world, something we do not see around these days. The United Nations will remember also that it tried to strengthen multilateral diplomacy. Therefore, his passing away is a great loss not only to the United States, but to the international community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdun, and our very able engineering team, we thank you for joining us tonight. Join us again on Saturday. I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.